I sort of have been debating this morning about what I talked about. There are some unfinished kind of things that I've been working on through the past, I suppose, 4 weeks. And I've decided today to begin a week anew with, in a sort of unrelated topic, mostly because I know about this topic anyhow, and it was touched on in a very definite but yet in a different kind of way in an earlier session this morning. And what I'd like to speak about and have us discuss this morning are problems that are very, very closely related and psychologically quite different, but they hang together. And I want to sort of explain what the psychologists know about these things, beginning with what we call frustration, and having this lead to fear, punishment, suffering. I guess this is a general area. These things are very closely related, and they often occur in common, and I want to just let you know what we know about them. And let me start out by relating this to what the earlier discussion was this morning. A definition, really, of frustration was given, and Mr. Cooper isn't here, Dr. Cooper isn't here, he's the one who made it, as really a stumbling block, or something that trips you up on the way that you're going. Let me give you the psychological definition, which says really the same thing. That frustration is a barrier to man's goal. Man has a goal. Man is a goal-oriented creature. We take this presupposition psychologically. And he constantly acts in order to win a reward or to obtain a goal. Whether this is in the short run that he's hungry and he wants some food, you see a very short space of time, or whether it might be a longer stretch, a person enters college in order to obtain a college degree, or even a longer stretch that he lives life in order, as a theologian might say, in order to somehow find union with God as his total life's goal. But man is a goal-oriented creature, and unfortunately for him, or maybe fortunately, I'm not sure theologically how this works, he constantly experiences frustration towards almost all of his goals. It might be a simple frustration. He might be a person who smokes cigarettes and he's out of cigarettes, and he has to work to overcome this barrier by buying a new package or borrowing a cigarette from someone. Or it may be a larger frustration that the situation is such so that he's hungry and he happens to live in parts of China or Latin America or Africa, or maybe in a part of a large city in the United States, or in a rural area like Appalachia in the United States, and the barrier is such that his hunger just cannot be fulfilled by anything that he does within his own physical limitations. If he tries to plant crops, the soil is so poor he can't grow them, or he can't afford the food for the seed, or his family is so large that whatever he does produce just can't satisfy this need. And this is a more serious type of frustration. But I think all of us, Grant, whether it's the bell ringing in the morning here, that doesn't allow our need for sleep to be satisfied at the time that we most would like it to be, you see, early morning hours. But at some time, and every day, constantly really, man is faced by this situation that he has a goal which is not being satisfied. There's a barrier there. His reinforcement or his reward is being delayed. Let me start talking first about what we know about the nature of frustration. And this, in turn, will lead us to these other topics of suffering and pain and punishment. Start with frustration. Okay. One of the first people to really, I think, in a psychological manner, deal with the problem of frustration was Sigmund Freud, again, who just suggested the problem. Freud's theory, and we talked about this in our interpretation, our psychological interpretation of the Adam and Eve story, suggests that man is by nature good. This was mentioned last hour too, that his main instincts or motivations or drives or sources of energy direct him for good purposes, for self-preservation, you see, keep himself alive, for preservation of the species, to give life to new people and preserve that life. It's a constructive, building up thing that allows for love, self-love and love of others. This, according to Freud, is the way man is conceived. But already in Freudian theory, the birth process already is a frustration. So that man, because his goal is blocked of allowing because he experiences frustration, because he experiences hardship, allow some of this original energy, which Freud calls libidinal energy. It satisfies the life instinct, which he calls eros. This life instinct is already at birth somehow channeled into its exact opposite, the death instinct, which he uses the Greek word thanatos, or a destructive process, so that man at birth already is very self-centered and has both of these principles waging within him now, both the principles for construction, life-preserving, and for destruction, tearing down, the destructive impulse being there because of the frustration of birth, the separation from mother. This is sort of Freudian theory. And Freud said that because of this, a person is, this frustration brings about this evil in him, this destructive process. It's a reaction to separation or to frustration. Now, Freud didn't have much else to say about this except for one thing. He made one special point about this, and then others go on from here. Freud said that frustration automatically, or he used the word inevitably, naturally, leads to aggression. It's man's primordial response to frustration, he said, to be destructive. Every time, like say that you want to sleep this morning and the bell ringer wakes you up, your first reaction is to take a hammer and club him over the head. Your first reaction to frustration is aggression. This is man's natural instinct. When an animal is attacked, he reattacks, or you see, defends himself aggressively. This is where Freud left off, that man's natural reaction to frustration is aggression. Then several other psychologists take it up from here and they investigate the nature of frustration. They find out lots of things about it. Two very prominent psychologists, their names happen to be Robert Sears and Neil Miller, and Dollard also was in here, and several others, investigated this more scientifically and said there are especially three factors that determine whether man's reaction to frustration is going, in fact, to be aggression. That one of them depends on how serious his need is, how strong his motivation is towards what he's not getting, you see, the frustration. Like, let's say you have two people, a chain smoker and somebody that smoked a cigarette when he was 12 years old and not since, and let's say they're in their 30s. Both of these people are, in a sense, frustrated in that they don't have cigarettes. You see, there's something that they don't have. One of these people wants it a lot more than the other one, and therefore he is likely to be more aggressive than the non-chain smoker. How hard is it to get what you want? Say you have a strong motivation, how strong is the barrier? If the barrier is a very strong one, you're more likely to be aggressive than if it's a weak one. Let's say you want cigarettes. If you can get them by paying a quarter, or now I guess it's almost 35 or 40 cents around here. If you have this money and you can pay it and there's a store available that sells them, you're not very frustrated or likely to be aggressive. But if you have to go from friend to friend and they all turn you down and you have to try many, many different places and still can't get one, you're more likely to be irritable than if your barrier is a small one. You're likely to be still more aggressive if not only your barrier is strong and you have a strong motivation, but you keep hitting your head against this brick wall. You keep trying and trying. You see, you have lots and lots of sequences where you attempt to overcome this strong barrier and you still fail. Well, that was their main contribution. Let me give you one example, for instance. And there are lots of other ways. This example, let's take the Vietnam War, maybe. Or we could take civil rights, or we could take almost any major event where there is aggression being shown. I mean, very obvious case of aggression, warfare. I mean, there's hardly anybody that doesn't agree this is a case of aggression. People are destroying each other, and this is what we mean by aggression. Let me define aggression. And there's been some controversy about whether this is a correct definition, but it's the one I'll use. Where man intentionally desires and carries out this desire to the extent it's possible, to destroy someone or something, if this is a case of aggression, the someone being much more emphasized than the something. So here we have a case of warfare. How do we explain it under what we already have talked about psychologically? Well, the psychologists say that any aggression implies a previous sense of frustration. So the war is being caused because some parties in the war are being frustrated. Now let's see what the causes of the frustration are. And they point in the Vietnam War not to the political reasons, like one of us is democratic and the other is, say, communistic, or the religious even, that one of us is Christian and the other is I don't even know, I guess Muslim or not Buddhist in that area. They were, I don't even know, but you see religious differences. But they point to more pertinent frustrations. Let me just illustrate one of these frustrations being hunger, that these people might feel that they don't have as much food. And I know of this very personally. We have a, I'll make this a little more personal in just the Vietnamese War. I think it's probably the same answer. We have adopted sort of, in Northfield, it's the custom for Northfield families to adopt international students, people from other lands as they attend St. Olaf College, or Crown College. And we have adopted a girl, a Negro girl from Panama, who lives with us whenever the dorms close at St. Olaf, either during the summer or the Christmas vacation or whatnot. And she's told us of this kind of frustration in Panama. She was trying to explain to us the reasons why the Panamanians had rioted and pulled down the American flag in the Canal Zone, and there had been several deaths and a big international uproar. And she said, you know, the real reason isn't so much political, just the fact that the United States doesn't pay us what we are owed by their, you know, their handling of the Panama Canal, that they give us, I think she said, $3 million a year, where in fact the revenue has gone up, so that they should be giving us something like $40 million a year, with some figure like this. He said, that's not really the reason for these riots against the Americans. He said, the real reason is this. Our family has been spending the last 2 years trying to save enough money out of that which we use for food and shelter to try to purchase a bicycle that we might have our transportation from home to various other places we must travel, make that transportation easier, especially for the father who's a working member and must commute. And they've been trying years to save enough money for a bicycle. And they live in the Canal Zone. And right next door, across the street, see, they've separated the Canal Zone from the Americans and the Panamanians. Right across the street, there are American families, each of which families have two cars and extra money, surplus money. And every day as they wake up and they put their penny or something into the bank to save for a bicycle, they watch these Americans use one car and leave the other one in the garage, you see. And she says, this is the reason really why there's so many riots. It's just not fair. These Americans have everything they need and much more, and we don't have even a bicycle. And it's the same thing of probably, you see, carrying the same thing out in war. That if you have people who are starving or who don't have enough industry to support the people of their land or agriculture or anything, and then they read in the newspapers, whether through communist propaganda or what, at least what happens to be true, that millions of tons of surplus wheat, for instance, rot every year in the United States, and their families are starving, and the mother goes to bed at night and hears her baby whimpering. This is a true story. I mean, I know these things are true. I haven't seen them always firsthand, but hear them secondhand from people that see them. That a mother will go to bed and stuff a wet rag into her young daughter or young baby's mouth because her milk supply, you see, she can't breastfeed anymore. She's too malnourished to supply milk, and they can't buy milk. And so the baby has to suck on this wet rag and become undernourished, and then the stomach hardens and bloats up, and then they have to do all kinds of drastic things. Sell what they have, or maybe sell their bodies, or break, sometimes they break the arms of their babies to make them beggars. You see very successful beggars sometimes. And these things happen, but it's a frustration. And this frustration leads to aggression very commonly. If you're starving and somebody else is wasting millions of tons of surplus wheat, there's an automatic reaction, the psychologists say, towards aggression. You know, either destroy or at least appropriate this property from other people. And very commonly it's destroy. If we're frustrated, destroy. Don't bother to work these out, but act out, you know, in a sort of a beast-like manner. And this I think was brought up very, very clearly this morning. It's a common impulse. We talked about the church structure, a very frustrating thing, that many times the Spirit of the Lord is not allowed to speak in many people associated in the hierarchy of the church, because there's something stifling about various parts of the structure. And the first common reaction to this frustration or this stumbling block is, destroy it. Or another reaction, let me talk about some of these defense mechanisms before I start making the points I want to make. This is as far as Dollard Miller went. Is to really show that Freud is right, and reasons why he's right, and what strengthens this, that frustration leads to aggression. The more frustrated a person is, the more aggressive he becomes. If the Negro cannot, and tries many times, have himself treated with the dignity that is given to other human beings, he must become aggressive. It's within the nature of the human animal for this frustration to cause, you know, the destruction of riots, for instance. Or, you see, this is the first impulse, but sometimes, because of certain situations, this natural impulse is not allowed. And it may be that there's too much punishment given aggression. You see, if you start a riot, we'll kill you. And sometimes this does deter riots, apparently. Or there are other situations where frustration is, or where aggression is just not possible. Then there are other things that happen. One of them is withdrawal, and we talked about that this morning. Run from the sinking ship. Leave it. Withdraw. Or the schizophrenics do this very commonly. They withdraw into a corner, and if what they really want is the love of other people and they don't get it, they'll sit themselves in a corner where they will not react to human beings at all. They just sit there. And regardless what you do for them, they will not react. And I've seen this happen. You see, a very severe case of withdrawal. Or there are other defense mechanisms that I won't go into in any detail, but just let you be aware of. Regression, or displacement of aggression, or depression, or intellectualization. This is a common one on college campuses. If what we really want is the respect and the love of other people, you see, respect that really is deserved us because we're human beings. If we can't get this, one of the things that we can do is hide from interpersonal reactions and withdraw into a shell, but do something symbolic of this. Increase our intellect and our knowledge and let everyone know what a terrific scholar we are. So that our A grades in our philosophical discussions, or it might be psychological discussions, or some kind of very, very intellectual discussion will show other people that we indeed are of value. And in fact, what it does, it cuts off what they really want, which is the love of these other people and the interaction, interpersonal relationships, and puts them in many times an ivory tower where they're out of reach of communication. But still, at least if they don't have the love, have the respect of other people. Oh, and they go on and on. There's a list of some 20 defense mechanisms that are quite common reactions to frustration. But always, say the psychologists, a defense mechanism is a reaction to frustration. That frustration is always bad. Frustration always makes a human being less human. It builds a wall around himself or some kind of defense mechanism that doesn't allow him to perfect what his true humanity is. That St. Paul, for instance, in the epistle says, there are faith, hope, and charity, and the greatest of these is charity, love. This is what really perfects a human being, is love. And that defense mechanisms always turn him away from love into something else, usually a self-centeredness in one way or another, or a destruction of someone else. Now, the psychologists have really proved this, and it would take me hours to show research, that frustration is always damaging to the human personality. Let me define frustration again. There is a goal for you, either self-imposed or imposed by your human nature. See, for food or for maybe union with God or something. And frustration is always a barrier to this goal. It always turns you away from God or away from food or away from whatever your goal is. And it's always damaging. But then a very funny thing happens. Psychologists have shown, too, that the most healthy personalities usually have experienced a great degree of suffering in their lives. See, this sounds impossible. How can I say this? How can I say that frustration is always damaging, but yet suffering seems to improve a person's mental health or his personality or his humanity? Suffering allows a person very commonly to love more intensely. Frustration allows him only to turn towards himself and away from love of other people. It sounds like first like a contradiction, right? I mean, it did for me when I first found these two things out. That how can it be that frustration is always harmful, but suffering is always helpful? And the answer was provided at first. The first glimpse of this, I guess, is a recent one. I'm sure other people have had this insight. But more recently, Viktor Frankl is the one who put his finger on this, and then the other psychologists have pointed out how true this is. That the difference between frustration and suffering is the difference between meaning or lack of meaning. That that frustration by its very definition always implies a lack of meaning. There's a goal for you, and what's happening is you're spinning your wheels in the mud and not going any place towards that goal, and that's frustrating. You're even being turned around away from it. You're sliding away from this goal. And this is always the nature of frustration. You want food, but you're hungry. You see, your goal is envisioned psychologically and biologically, then is the attainment of food. And your frustration is that you can't have the food. Now, what Viktor Frankl has shown is that suffering is very different from this. Suffering always brings you closer to a goal. It might be a painful experience and it might deter you from certain goals, but it always leads you towards a different one. Let me give the example that he gives in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. It was at first for him when he was put into a concentration camp. He was a Jew living in Vienna, Austria at the time of the Second World War. And he was imprisoned, put in a concentration camp by the Nazis. And at first it was frustrating for him. He was separated from his family, including his wife of a very short time, it was I guess a few years or maybe even less than that, and from his father and mother and all the rest of his family. He sort of suspected, which later turned to be true, that all of his family had been killed except for one, I think one of his sisters. But at first this was a very frustrating experience. His goal in a sense was freedom, the ability to work as a psychiatrist, the ability to be a healer in the midst of other people. And it was very frustrating for him to be put in these camps. And at first his mental health in many ways suffered. I didn't mean to use that word suffer because I'm trying to explain here how suffering is, how it was hurt. Until he realized that this experience was in fact not just blocking him from these goals, but was aiding him towards a larger goal, which he sought to be in the nature of an ultimate good, which he in fact defined as God in the Jewish tradition, not the Christian tradition. That what was happening here really was two different things that were helping him towards a larger goal. Rather than stopping him from littler goals, they were in fact an asset towards a larger goal. He found meaning in this experience because two things. It allowed him to understand himself and other human beings at a much greater depth. He saw himself and other human beings in all kinds of situations that wouldn't have been possible in the other world. Situations involving extreme torture and deprivation. And he noticed some very significant truths about human beings under these situations, how it affected different people differently because of various situations. And he came up with this truth that he now has established in his psychological theory of logotherapy, that man's greatest need is for meaning. And in fact, one of the greatest assets for human beings is to be able to understand that their frustrations do not ever have to be frustrating, but can be a form of suffering leading them on to a greater meaning. That when you're deprived of something, it always can be viewed as a way towards a greater good. This is possible psychologically to do, and he points it out in many of his case histories how he does this with people. And in his own life, how separation from family, extreme torture, led him to a deeper understanding of himself and also of a closer relationship to his God and to a commitment to love, a God of love as an ultimate good. And he makes a statement in this book that he began, that it was only through this experience that he realized the truth that poets have often proclaimed, that the salvation of man is in love and through love, that it's the only thing really that gives man this healing strength or this salvation. So Viktor Frankl started this, and other psychologists carried out to show that the only thing that makes a person really healthy, see, because he constantly is being frustrated one way or another, is to be able to view his frustrations not as frustrations but as suffering, as something that might be hard to endure but that leads him to a greater goal. That this in fact is possible for human beings to do, especially if they receive love and support in whatever their frustration might be. There is no human being, the psychologists say, who is without knowledge of frustration. But there also is no human being who can't turn this frustration into a meaningful instead of a meaningless experience. And that by giving meaning to frustration, it no longer is frustration, but strengthens the personality. Now why? Well, let me just cite you some examples before we get to the reasons why, just to show you that this happened. One very personal example that sticks out very, very much in my mind. Well, there are the examples of the athlete first, for instance, huh? A person who tortures himself physically. And you read some of these examples of Glenn Cunningham, for instance, who after his terrible fire, tortured himself, making himself walk and then run further and further to build up his endurance. The physical torture that was involved, that was not a form of frustration, but a form of suffering. It led him to be able not only to walk, but set for many years the world's mile record for the mile run. Or the other athletes that do the same thing. They torture themselves physically, but it has meaning, and so it's not seen as frustration. But I'm right now thinking of a letter my brother wrote me. He's now a captain in the Marine Corps, 5 miles outside of Da Nang Air Force Base, experiencing lots of suffering right now. He's in charge of 100 men, and every day some of them are killed. immense suffering that he has to go through to write the letters to the parents, because he's the commanding officer. But some of the letters he wrote me while he was still in officer's training showed this truth, I think, to a large degree. That he was with a group of men and they were tortured. Some of the things are unbelievable, the way these drill sergeants tortured these men physically and mentally. Constant harassment of a very severe nature. But he said it was a surprising thing that all of this torture built up the morale of his group. These men became fused together as a unit. And he sometimes used the word a fighting unit, and he developed a sort of esprit de corps, the Marine Corps, about which we have several interesting conversations. But one of the things that did happen to him is that when he suffered with another group of human beings, somehow he was able to, not only able to, but necessarily had to, love them intensely with a love that he reserves for very few people. As you experience torture with other human beings, somehow the nature of the bond of these human beings becomes very strong. As we all suffer together in one way or another, it draws us closer together. There's something unavoidable about this human response to somehow be able to love a co-fellow sufferer. I can't explain yet, the psychologists are sort of working on this, what it is about this, but there's something very true about this. That as you suffer, you begin to understand and appreciate and love more intensely those other people who suffer. Now this experience then we can carry out in many, many other kinds of situations. In fact, one of the people who gave a convocation at school some years back, Evelyn Duval, her name was, and the kids made fun of her for a lot of different reasons, because she presented everything in a very homey style instead of an intellectual one. One thing that she said that made a lot of sense to me is that love even can at times be defined as the experiences we share together. And the more intense these experiences, whether of joy or of sorrow, the more intensely they bind human beings together. There's a lot more I could say about this, but I guess let me first ask if there are any questions. If there are, I'll answer them. Then I want to show how this is related to a different topic, that of punishment. You see how we start out with frustration and turn to suffering and then turn to punishment, and how these are related. Ruth, go ahead. It's funny that there are sometimes two very different reactions to this, depending on whether it's looked at as frustration or suffering, I suppose. I've noticed the same thing that you have, exactly the same. I talked with a woman once who told me that she was a woman, she and her husband were very much in love and wanted to have children in such a deep way. They wanted to give their love to their children. And she had something like 7 miscarriages and couldn't have any children of her own. And some of her children had been born only to die. And she found in this, a very deep suffering, but one that allowed her to give up herself so completely she became a missionary. And she worked so well with the younger children in this as a missionary and brought them so much love, so that as they grew up, really, she became a very significant force. And that she didn't tell me it in these words, but as we talked, it became very obvious that this woman's love for these people was really much more intense because of her suffering. But I've talked with people that have had exactly the opposite experience. I can't do, and it isn't that they've lost children, but maybe that they have a child who is retarded or in some other way sick. This is such, I can't understand why God would have this affliction brought on me, and they become hateful about it. And instead of allowing them to love more, they hate more. They love less. And this is a reaction I've seen happen to some people even that have talked to me about various tragedies in their life, how it's made them bitter instead of loving. And I think that I've noticed that in each case, it's because they react to it differently. Some of them view this as frustration and others view it as suffering, that there is a meaning to this experience and all I need to do is find it. Whereas the frustrated people are the ones, there's absolutely no meaning to this. It's an accident of fate and there's no meaning to it and it makes me bitter. And there is a difference in the personality whether you view an experience as frustrating or as suffering, I think, with or without meaning. It makes a great deal of difference. But I've seen this happen in many cases, exactly what you said. That an experience of a bad nature in some ways turns out to be a good for the person. It strengthens him. Even people have written biographies of John Kennedy and said he never would have been the man he was if it weren't for his terrible back trouble. But this experience of pain allowed him to endure so much, and you see. Well, any other comments I didn't? That was a good thing.
Your example about training these moves right there. From what I've heard, this experience would be what I would call more frustration than suffering, because I'm not trained not to find the meaning of what they're doing, but just to rule out a command without any reason.
That might be true for some, but the meaning my brother found in this is twofold, really. This builds up my physical endurance, you see, that's one meaning. But a really larger meaning that he found in it is, this allows me to be an officer instead of one of the enlisted men. And everybody there had this same meaning in common. If we wash out on this, we're going to be one of the enlisted men that'll really have it bad off. But if we make it, see, we're all in this to try to be officers together. And they found a real meaning in this meaninglessness of the drill sergeant, because there's a goal at hand. This is the goal we're working for, to be an officer and be in charge of these drills. Some of them had the goal, because then I'll be able to order these guys around. But there was a goal.
Officer candidate school is a matter of survival.
In a sense, that's true, although the people that don't survive, just they go a different place.
It's not survival.
Take the example, though, of a regular drafted person who doesn't have this goal of becoming an officer. Me, well, I've talked to some kids, and they say they go through this, and he says, most of it's just meaningless, and they do ridiculous things, say they have no meaning at all.
And would you say that strengthens or weakens the personality to do it this way?
Well,
or to experience it this way?
It does it militarily. In effect, you said it combines it with people, people suffering together, naturally work together. Plus, it makes for, since you said frustration, causes aggression. And they can channel this aggression that they're forming then on the enemy. I know a number of people that I've talked to have said that they've known people that are just as kind and friendly as can be, nice as people you want to know, but after they go through this, that they become trained, become so frustrated and so aggressive that all they can think of is that they want to kill.
Nevertheless, see, there's a truth and also an area that's lacking here. Many of these same people who feel terribly frustrated do feel very close to each other because of this frustration. The two people in the foxhole and their mortars dropping all around can find themselves in a very close relationship, even though it might be just, you know, that they're helping each other survive or that they're in this together. But if a person is able to find meaning out of this experience, he usually benefits a lot more than if he isn't. The more frustrating the experience is, the more likely this person is to crack mentally. The more meaning he finds in it, the more likelihood he has of retaining his mental health. See, that's one of the real problems in warfare, that a person who starts to realize that his only purpose of being there is to kill the enemy can find this a terribly frustrating experience and very meaningless. That he has to reinforce himself that it's not just that, but that the real meaning there is to save his loved ones or his country or something. And then he's able not to crack under the strain lots of times.
But which way are they trained? Are they trained to find meaning in, or are they trained just to want to kill?
Well,
I think that's a really cheap way to get people to go
out
and kill an enemy.
Well, see, I'm not arguing for or against military training now. I mean, that's really not, I mean, we could get into a discussion about that. But what I am saying, I think, is that even under these circumstances, that it affects people differently depending on whether they view it as frustration or as suffering, whether they find meaning in it or don't find meaning in it, that the people who will be mentally weakened are those who can't find meaning in this experience. You see, if they can't find meaning in it, what I say is that they maybe shouldn't do it, that they should be a conscientious objector. But that's another story. You know, we could really spend a lot of time about the morality of warfare. And I just assume not now, but maybe for later. You had your hand up.
When you speak of suffering or frustration, cannot this change, say if a person has something tragic happen within their family? Their attitude changes, say, within the first months or the first years. Can't it change from one of suffering where there's a meaning in it to one of frustration?
Or just the opposite. Let me give you an example that Viktor Frankl uses in his book. A man who also was in the prison camp and had his entire family killed, but he survived. And he became a miserable person because he thought, what is the sense of this? My surviving alone, unloved, and not only that, but in his religious tradition, I'll never again see my family. They're martyrs. And I'm not a martyr. I'll die of a natural cause, and therefore they're in a higher place in heaven than I. And I'm terribly alone. What a meaningless, frustrating thing to be saved, you know, and be so alone, to have my family dead. And he was really on the verge of committing suicide several times, and he saw Viktor Frankl. And all that Frankl did is point out to him a meaning in his existence. And granted, you know, you might not agree with this, whether, you know, theologically it might be unsound, or there might be a lot of things you're saying, this is a gimmick. But the point I'm trying to make is, for this man, it changed his whole mental picture. Frankl said to him, look at, what's happened is you've been spared in order to suffer very severely. And this suffering will purify you to the same high state in heaven that your family's in. So that the reason you've been spared is so that you too might be a martyr in a sense and be reunited with them at your death. And that sentence alone made this man view this so differently. No longer was it frustrating, but now it was a suffering that had a meaning. And his mental health, no longer did he contemplate suicide. He welcomed it, and he became strong mentally instead of weak mentally. See, and all that happened is he viewed this now as suffering instead of frustration. It had a meaning. It was no longer meaningless. Now, I grant you that there's a lot of weaknesses in this technique, you know, at least from our Christian point of view, about whether, in fact, it might be true or whether he might not be playing with words. I don't know. But it worked, you see. All that need happened in it, and a radical transformation took place. One from a suicidal person to a very happy person, satisfied. I found meaning in my frustration, so it's no longer frustration. See, these things do happen.
I don't, I want to ask you a question. I don't know that there's an answer in five words or less, but I think I know I could have used you last week. I spent a week on the trail backpacking with 30 teenagers from a juvenile detention home. And it's it's some kind of experience. It's the first time that I've been out with them. And largely their frustrations and their problems, from the boys that I got closer to were home problems. And frankly, I really, because I've never studied this kind of thing, really didn't know how to change what you're saying of frustrations into a meaningful experience outside of giving of yourself. And sometimes the trip liver was a little thing, you know, trade a red gum wrapper with a kid for a GI can opener, something he'd never seen before and loved you for it.
Well, I'm certain that's the answer. This is something else that many psychologists disagree with, but I firmly believe, and many psychologists do too, that the only thing in the whole world that ever does provide meaning, that is ever capable of providing meaning to our existence, is the experience of love. Nothing else, ever. And I've seen this happen. I will, in fact, now that I've brought this up, tell you one more true story. This is a person that I know and really, I guess I could say love quite a bit right now. I don't get messed up on words, you know, because it happens to be a girl, and I don't want to, you know, I just really, really appreciate it very much. But when I first met her, I walked into my office, and I have the practice at St. Olaf of leaving my office door unlocked for many reasons. Some of the secretaries I have don't have keys. We use part-time student secretaries. But I walked in and was very surprised by the appearance of this girl. She had a chair that had been drawn up to my desk on not my side, but the other side. And she was half slumped on the floor, half on the chair, and half on the desk in a real, you know, real, just total collapse. She wasn't really put together. It was sort of like an amoeba, just collapsed on there, on these three sections of the area of my office. And she was sobbing, just very moving experience. Very seldom does anybody sob like that. And she'd been waiting for me, and I don't know for how long. Just she said, well, for a while now, when she regained enough composure to talk. And she started talking about this. There were several things that happened in her life. She was a very pretty, very intelligent girl, and very rich. You know, she had everything that most of the people envied her for. You know, good looks, brains, and wealth. And everyone else around her would think she has everything in life really that life has to offer. And yet, she could find absolutely no meaning in her existence. She said, why should I go to school, for one thing? See, that's what she was doing now. She didn't find any meaning in this at all. She had been getting A's, now all of a sudden she was, this last semester she'd been getting D's and F's, just because all of a sudden she'd realized there's no meaning in this. What sense does it make to go to school and learn something the teacher says and vomit it back to him on the paper or read this book, you know, what difference does it make? What meaning is there? It's meaningless. What difference does it make if I have lots of money? What difference does that make? Or you know, if I myself or marry somebody that makes $1 million? What meaning does that have? What purpose to an existence like that? What meaning is there to get up in the morning? We get up and we work and we die. And what meaning is there? You know, there's none. It's a meaningless existence. And she talked this way and believed it. And she really said, what meaning does life have? You know, it's sort of like an empty shadow that walks across the stage for a minute and is gone, like Shakespeare says. And there's nothing to it. You know, why not end it? It's so much suffering. The mornings are so gray so often. Why not end it? There's no meaning here at all. And it turned out, as we talked, that what she really was saying is, and this came out very clearly, nobody loves me. There are some guys who are being sexual with me. My parents give me lots of things, but nobody really loves me. Nobody really reacts to me like they're happy to be with me because I'm good inside. Nobody sees any real good in me. Some people use me, but they don't see me as having good. And that's why life is meaningless, because nobody loves me. And I saw this girl be transformed from this meaningless existence of frustration and no hope to a girl who is just completely, almost completely opposite. She's having a problem now, and in many senses I don't know how that can be avoided, but she now experiences the love of some people. She knows that there are some people who care about her, and this took a while to convince her, and it wasn't too easy, but she now experiences love of some people, and she's happy. And she finds meaning. She thinks it's good to go to school now and get grades and to get up in the morning. She finds a real meaning in it, and if you ask her what meaning is there, she can't tell you. It isn't that there's a real meaning in getting A's in school or a real meaning in whatever work she's doing, but somehow it's meaningful because now someone loves her. And she's experiencing a problem now with her peer group. She has now sort of a reputation of a girl that the guys can take out and be sexual with, and of a girl who will drink with the group and who will go to the kind of wild parties, you know, I hate to call them orgies, but the sexual and drinking parties that sometimes happen at places. And now she won't be part of this group so much anymore. She's found a different group. And she isn't totally accepted by a different group because they all know her reputation. And she's really sort of excluded from her former group because now she's sort of got a new reputation. And so she's kind of in no place. But yet she does have some people now who love her. And this gives her the meaning in life, even though her peer group hasn't quite accepted her. Either the wild group, they've sort of excluded her, and the other group that she wants to be a part of now hasn't accepted her yet. And so she's sort of lost and alone, and she has problems about that. But she's really a radically different person. I mean, when I talk with her now, she comes over to the house quite often, and we'll sometimes, you know, we do dumb things. We'll play a game of Scrabble, or we'll just sit around and eat popcorn and watch TV or something, you know, that really... You know, in a different situation might be a waste of time. But with her, it's just a delightful experience. And she's full of life and full of meaning. And the whole transformation is because now somebody loves her.
In this this parable that Jesus talks about somebody getting clean of some devils, and then going around in waterless places, there's a transition over there. And he went back to his house, clean and swept. He takes with him so many other devils, and his last situation is worse than the first. There is something that fits all of him.
You're saying that maybe she's changed, but she's likely to fall worse than she was before.
Well, I hate to pinpoint it on the girl, but there is this too, but in other situations also.
Well, I can think of an alcoholic who is probably my best friend outside of the family, who we worked with like mad. He went to Hazelden for a while, an alcoholic rehabilitation center, and had this transformation, you know. Now his house is swept clean, everything's fine. He went to the AA meetings, he was a wonderful transformed person. And the second instance, the second experience of alcoholism for him, his kind of fall, was much worse than the first. Much worse, financially, psychologically, physically, much worse. And now he's picking himself up from the second one, hopefully, or he's, you know, he's being helped, being picked up.
Well, then it seems like there's really meaning. I mean, in the frustration, if God made us, I mean, it seems like everything is in its order. the leaves come off like the autumn. The cells are just perfect. The flowers come out in a perfect way. Even this trouble that we have must have meaning, and therefore it has to have. These people that you say pull through, who have some meaning. It's very possible that the last state might be worse than the first, and they could be perfectly healthy people. I mean, looking at upon it, and some people say spiritual reality is not real. But yet, if the person can look for meaning, it has to have what we would say, something that's even psychological, and from the scriptural standpoint, then we'd say it's the real meaning. It promotes something that it's a thought, and it enters into this realm. So therefore, this spiritual, to fill in the gap, really is our goal.
Well, that was kind of in that first. You still want to put your other hand up, and then I will.
And here's where I would like to say that, we as Christians feel like Christ has died for that person, and we owe that person a chance. I mean, in our everyday lives, we come across people all the time, and don't accept somebody in our group who is trying to change, whether it be an alcoholic.
I think there's a lot of what she said is what I was going to say. I think there's two things. We could talk about the nature of evil in the world, you know, whether it's real, and if it's real, is it a positive or a negative force? And I think a lot of that is implied in the nature of your question. But I think, too, that just psychologically, that Ruth's answer is right. That the only thing ever that gives meaning to any human being is the knowledge that he's loved, regardless if he's starving, or regardless if he's an alcoholic, or regardless of what. Or if he's wealthy, or if he's full and content. The only thing ever that gives meaning to a man's life is the fact that he's loved. And a Christian constantly has this knowledge that he's loved. And so he should always find meaning in life, regardless of his external situation. He has meaning because he's loved. He's loved whether he's an alcoholic, or whether he's the President of the United States, or whether he's anybody. And this should give him meaning. Now then, we could talk, you know, it's a way long other discussion to really carry this out. What about the nature of evil? You know, you talk about the world being ordered, and how do we know whether it's better or worse in a chain situation? And I just want to save that too, because we'd be here forever. But I think that one of the answers is that a person does find meaning if he's loved. And a Christian knows he's loved. And that's all the meaning he needs, really. Go ahead.
Isn't this, doesn't it go back a little bit to this first year in a child's life? If a child, as it grows from the moment it's born, it learns to trust. I mean, that it feels that.
Were you present at the earlier lectures or talks I gave about that? Or
no, are
you,
no.
Well, that's exactly what I said in those. I was just wondering if you were sort of helping me out here.
No, yeah. I wasn't here when you were first. Yeah.
I agree with you 100%.
It's very important.
Sure.
If you don't learn it there, it's much harder as you're older. But if a child grows with this,
you know, that's one of the things I've been meaning to talk to Edna about after reading her book about 6 or 7 times. That one interpretation that I think also might be valid about this statement, unless you enter the kingdom of heaven as a little child, might just actually be, and I never looked at the words and I wouldn't know what they meant if I did look at them in the original, but in the English translation I sometimes have wondered if this might not mean, unless you are a little child when you enter the kingdom of heaven. See, unless you enter the kingdom of heaven as a little child. That it might not mean that, it might just mean unless in your early years you receive this love, it's pretty hard for you ever to receive it. That's just one of the things I was going to play around with you about, because you worked at this so many different directions. That it might just be a literal statement that you almost have to accept salvation as an infant, or you never really get it, because it's what happens to you in your first few years that are so terribly crucial. Whether you receive the love of your parents, or, you see, which stand in place of God. The revelation of God to an infant comes through the parents. And if an infant is never loved as a child, he may never be able to really receive or give love. Unless, and we know this, say, like a schizophrenic who's 15 or 16 years old, right now what they do is regress him psychologically back to age one and give him the same kind of love. They let him have his temper tantrums, they feed him and dress him and do everything to give him the love that he should have gotten as a little baby, and then he starts growing psychologically and comes out of schizophrenia. That this might be one possible way of looking at this too, which, and any of you who have never read Ben Nahon's book, you have really missed an awful lot. I sometimes feel like we're supporting the Hans because I bet we've bought 20 copies of that book to give away. It's so delightful. I'm embarrassing her, but I didn't mean to say that, you know.
What can keep some people from believing that they're loved?
Well, this gets into a long story. First and foremost, at a young age, communication of love can be done only by physical presence and tactile stimulation, touch. That's the only way a little kid can ever know it's love. Later on, we can do things that are symbolic of this. See, we can write letters to sort of stand for our physical presence. We can call on the telephone. We can, you know, there are various ways of communication. But first and foremost, and the most important way, and people of every age realize this is still the most important way, is tactile stimulation. That's why people marry. It's what?
No, go on. You finished?
Yeah. And then you both
no, come. And the less intellectual a mother is, the better she is, it seems. You know, I don't know if you know Mrs. Cruz in Northfield, but she wasn't able to have children with her husband. And so she foster mothered children, but they're always coming and taking them away from her. So finally said, don't you have some children I can keep? So they started to bring her retarded children, hydrocephalic children with liver complications, so they were doomed to die within 6 weeks, and mongoloids, and she just seemed to be like a cow with her love. I mean, the more something needed her love, the more her love just flowed. And she's not at all intellectual. She's, in fact, she's sort of a little simple in some ways. But she handles these children, she loves them, she laughs, she sings, and she gets more out of these children than anybody I know. And the doctors in town are amazed at her. She'll take a child that the doctor says the child won't live past 6 months. Well, the child is now 12 years old. And the child talks. She'll take a child, the doctor says the child will never talk. And pretty soon that child is toilet trained, talking, responding with love, and she also is very strict with them. But it's strictness and love, and it's handling, holding.
Do you want to know the three things that psychologists say are important? And in this order, love, trust, and consistency of discipline. Those are the only three things that matter. I could give it a whole hour. I do to my kids at school.
Sometimes I'm a little appalled. She's sharp. She's like, you get up on that chair. No. And the child gets up in the chair. But really, they love her, the way they run to her. You know that she loves them. So tell me that again.
Love, trust, consistency of discipline. No, don't get hung up on this consistency of discipline. It doesn't mean consistency of punishment.
Yeah.
It means consistency of both punishment and reward.
Yeah.
See, those three things are all that really matter. Go ahead, I've been holding.
No, I'm cool now.
Oh, I mean,
this question of consistency both ways is what really concerns me. And I have feeling of a strong sense that if you get into a rut from an early time on and repetition of the wrong kind of approach or the wrong way of expressing meaning to an infant or growing up is the most devastating thing that can happen. And that most of the things later on that seem also to me ally themselves somewhat closely to that, around that given area where you have a hang up or where it's been mixed up. And some of the examples I see of that are kids that were placed in adoption that have been in four, five, or six different living arrangements, you know. And particularly where they miss one aspect or another through their given relationship, and each time it was cut off. And then they had to rebuild and restart the search again. The amount of energy that they put, an infant or a child puts into researching, is fantastic. And that's the point that it's really difficult to describe, where they get, some of them get the energy to come up with this and then overcome it. And this is real suffering.
Yeah. No, I'm not, I agree with everything of your, that I understand. I didn't get your first sentence really when you said that one of the real hang-ups is consistency of too much of the wrong thing or something. And that's, maybe that's what you were explaining.
Trying to explain. No, if you need consistency, if you need consistent love and love expressed in your behalf and understand it this way, sometimes we see what seems to us not love at all, but yet to whoever it is, and it's hard for us to figure out how this works. But going back, if this child or this person gets the same kind of a rut, the same kind of problem all along, and I think I worked with two little girls that had lived in 16 different living arrangements, and they were 4.5 to 5.5. And it had been the kind of thing where the father had gotten ill, physically called him, and break the situation, almost frustrating. Then next, the mother tried for a period of time, but had to move away to get jobs and what. She tried to limit her grandparents. The grandparents were in a situation for a while, and they were the ones who started the mother finally to come to seek some outside help. Now, the only thing that they had between each other was their own trust between one another. If you'd have separated those two kids, you would have literally destroyed them in terms of, because it's the only relationship. But they had the very, very strong notion that no matter what you did, that they took them 3 weeks in a new living situation before they could go to school. And this consistency of the wrong kind of thing.
Or really what we call inconsistency,
yeah,
in a sense. Kind of, they didn't receive consistent treatment from anybody, it seemed like, except for the fact that they're... But why don't we do this? Because it's obvious that we're running out of time. Everybody leave who doesn't have a question, and anybody who has a question, why don't we just discuss in a smaller group? Could we do that?
Would you please just be quiet about...
All right. Let me give you one quick definition, and if you like, we can... All right. An operational definition. How can you tell if you're loved or not? Let's start with that. Someone reacts to you or acts towards you like this. I'm happy to be with you. The closer, the better, because there's so much good in you. That's an example of love. Okay?
What if the fellow you're relating to or the person you're relating to,
then you don't love him. If all you see in him is bad and no value, you don't love him. Anybody you love, you see value in. You see good in him. I think it's a lie for a mother to say, you know, I love my kids despite the fact that they're such, you know, evil little brats, you know, that there's not a stitch of good in them. And I don't think she loves
them. You love a person merely by accepting them for what they are and not trying to remake them.
No, I think that's wrong. For instance, my alcoholic friend. I think it wouldn't be love for him to accept him the way he is when he was an alcoholic, but instead to recognize the good in him and try to bring the good out and see alcoholism as a barrier to that good. See, I could have accepted him for, I mean, anybody could have. I mean, I wasn't the one who really committed him to handle him, but anybody could have said, well, just accept him for the way he is, you know, he's an alcoholic. I don't think that's real love. I think every time if you really love a person, you don't just accept him for exactly what he is, but you really love him and are attracted to them for the goodness in them, and you even try to increase that goodness or experience that goodness more fully. Well, see, that's my definition, in my opinion. You know, it's true that other people sometimes disagree.
Well,
but that's the definition.
Regret if I was an alcoholic and you didn't accept my alcoholism or whatever.
You see it as a threat at first.
Sure,
he did too. But it really, I think real love would mean that you still, in a sense it's a threat because you become so dependent on alcohol. But in other ways, every alcoholic really realizes too how much they're damaging themselves psychologically and physically and their relationship with other people, including their family. And they really want to be cured, even though they fight it like mad at first. Just awfully bad.
It's possible, somebody wants to murder you.
Well, not for me. But see, I'm saying a real Christian maybe would love your enemies. I couldn't do it. If somebody wanted to murder me, I'd shoot them if I had a chance. You know, but that's me. See, I'm not, a real Christian wouldn't do that.
Well, aren't we being judgmental when we say we must bring out all these good things in them and can't accept them for what they are? We're trying to change them for into something else that we want them to be?
Well, see, what we're doing depends on what the nature of good is. If we understood perfectly the nature of good and we were attracted to good, that would be perfect love. But some people try to change other people over, in fact, to make them into something that is not good, but that they see as good. You know, instead of letting this guy be some kind of an occupation where he's not making much money, convince him of the fact he should change into one that makes more money, like a wife that says to her husband, don't do that, and don't be a school teacher, you know, because they don't make any money. Be a president of a bank instead, you know, then you'll be much better and I'll love you more. See, that's not love. But it's because what's good is at stake here. Money does not necessarily have more value than some other. See, that's the point. What I'm saying is this definition of love is correct if we understand truly the nature of good. But that, see, and I think good is not relative, it is absolute. But so many people, at least imperfectly, see the nature of goodness. And what might be good in this person, they don't even see as good and aren't attracted to as good. But a person who really loves you does have his attraction for you because there is good in you, and he will be interested in seeing this good expand and be fulfilled.
Because it's there, or because he sees the potential to develop something?
I think either one. Well, not that, see, then it isn't really good if what he'd like to develop, in fact, is not good. This is why so many people have such terrible relationships, is because they love somebody for something that is not good. Maybe she has a 38, 24, 36 figure, you know, and that's what we're going to really develop, you know, and, you know, or something like that. And this is not just a joke. I've seen it happen so many times that the good in you is your physical figure or something. And that's why I love you. We'll do everything. We'll put you on a diet, and we'll do all these things to increase that good. And it's not really a good. It might be beauty in a sense, but they miss the point.
Miss the point of love.
Well, yes, that's right. Or otherwise, the nature of goodness. Maybe both. I think if a person really understood the nature of goodness, really understood it, that he could be a truly loving person. And see, that's what I think it means, man to be made in the image and likeness of God. That what we do is we recognize God in that person and we try our hardest to help bring out that godliness in him. See, we're attracted to the godliness in him, and what we're really trying to do is help that person bring out the God in us, the goodliness in us. And that's what a real love relationship does. If I really love you, you allow me to be more good, and I allow you to be more good, and I like both of those things to happen. See, I'm not satisfied with myself as I am either, and you help change me by our relationship. But I also hopefully help change you by our relationship, so that you in fact are a more happy person with me than you are without me, or because of our relationship. See, that doesn't mean that we're always dependent on each other, but... That's exactly what Eric Erickson, one of the brightest psychologists, says, that for two people to really experience a sense of intimacy or true love, they should first know themselves and recognize what good they have, and then fuse the nature of this goodness for a common good. And that's the only thing that can make a real sense of intimacy, he says. And it involves self-knowledge and knowledge of the other, and then a fusion of the goals or values or something of this nature that imply good. Or that give meaning to life. And we could go on for hours about history, you know, I think everybody probably we've used our hour up that we all should leave, but those of you who have, you know, burning questions, you stay and everybody else go. And I didn't anywhere near finish. Let's next time then talk about the nature of punishment. Let me tell you this experiment done by a man named Brown, done in 1938, I believe. Reported in a book by Dollard and Miller. What Brown did is take a group of rats individually and place them in a quite large compartment, a rather large box-like thing, and the compartment had two sections, or the box had two compartments. One of the sides was blackened in. It was a black compartment, and it was sectioned off, and there was a door in the middle, and the door was open. The other side of the compartment was a white compartment. You get the picture? A big box with a dividing wall and a doorway. The rat is placed into the black part of the box. Now, the black part of the box has an electric grid underneath it, and the rat is shocked. It's given a what we call a moderate intensity shock, one that is strong enough on its first occurrence to induce defecation and urination. This is the strength. They also recorded this shock in voltage or amps or something. I don't recall now what that was anymore, but it's a moderate shock. And the rat runs around like mad and eventually goes out the door into the white compartment the first time. The next time they put him in there, and he already is very apprehensive and is likely to run into the white compartment, but they shock him again, and he learns very, very quickly, he learns, to escape the black compartment to go to the white compartment. Now, notice what's happened here. He learns a response to avoid pain. There's a pain stimulus, a punishment, or what we call a negative reinforcement, an aversive stimulation, an electric shock. And this gives him pain, and so he runs into the white compartment to avoid the pain. Now they do something else. They put him back into the compartment, the black compartment, shut the electricity off. But he's afraid to stay in the black compartment and wants to go to the white compartment. But how much afraid? They measure this by means of a little harness device attached to weights on a pulley. And they find that the rat of this species will pull with a weight that is, on the average, 200 grams. He pulls with a force of 200 grams in order to avoid this fearful stimulation of this black compartment to get to the white compartment. 200 gram stimulation. Okay, that's part of the experiment, but the most significant part is the contrast. He pulls with a force of 200 grams in order to escape fear, not pain, but just his fear response. See, the electricity's off. How hard will he pull for what we call a reward? See, now he's pulling for 200 grams to avoid punishment. That's how strong punishment is. How strong will it say? It's not the same rat, it's the same species of rats. All these are identical weights and identical training and everything, except they have different experiments. Now they place a rat in the black compartment who has never before been shocked in there. It's a neutral compartment for him. And they put food in the white compartment. He learns very quickly that when he's hungry, he walks from the black compartment to the white compartment. Then they starved this rat for various periods of time, and they found that 46 hours starvation gives the strongest possible motivation for this rat without weakening him enough, so that he'll pull with the hardest force at 46 hours starvation. After 46 hours, they place the rat in the black compartment, put this harness around him, and see how hard he'll pull in order to get food, which is a very powerful reward when you're that hungry. 46 hours to a rat, I suppose it'd be quite a bit longer for a human stomach. And very powerful motivation. Now, how hard do you suppose he pulls to get a reward instead of a punishment? Which do you suppose would be the stronger? Well, how many people feel that punishment is stronger here than reward? How many feel that reward is stronger than punishment? That's what you would think. Most parents believe this, that reward is stronger than punishment. You should love your child and reward him. But the rat pulls with a force of 50 grams on the average for food. This harness. Now that's one experiment, okay? This part, and they do this not only with food, but they do it with other kinds of positive reinforcement, rewards. They'll put, for instance, a female rat in heat on the other side of the wall. And he pulls with approximately the same as with food. There's quite a bit of deviation in the rats, but not anywhere as near as strong as he will in order just to escape fear. And they'll put all kinds of positive reinforcements there. And they find that food is really as strong as any, and that's four times less powerful than reward for this rat. Now let me tell you about some other experiments. You see, what I'm going to do is build up a kind of a heavy weight of evidence for the importance of punishment, and then we're going to discuss it and see just what we can and what we can't imply from these studies. Take another situation. And I forget who did this experiment. I left all my notes in Northfield about this topic, but I remember fairly well. Probably reported by Skinner, but I just can't recall. A rat that's put in a situation where he's in what we now call a Skinner box, a little box where he pulls a lever every so often. And he's been trained now that when he pulls this lever, he'll get food, a lever press, a bar press, gets a food pellet in this box. So he feeds himself by pressing the bar. Then what happens is, instead of being rewarded by pressing the bar, that's a different experiment. He's punished, but that isn't the one I guess that I want to tell. It doesn't make the point, so let me start over with the same rat, same situation, who's learned to press the bar. Now what happens is this. He's given an electric shock every 8 seconds. This is what we call a fixed interval reinforcement schedule. Every 8 seconds, the rat gets a shock. But every time he presses the bar, he delays the shock for 8 seconds. So if he presses the bar every 7 seconds, he'll never get a shock. You follow that? Any question about this methodology now? Now, it takes the rat a while. He's learned how to press the bar already for food. And it takes him a while to learn to press the bar to delay the shock. And this will take quite a few shocks before he finally learns this. But once he learns it, and then we start the experiment really there, he's learned now that pressing the bar delays the shock. A typical rat, this is approximate now. I really should have my notes to be exact, but this is approximate, but it's very, very close to the truth. A typical rat will go for 9 hours in 7 more shocks, over 14,000 bar presses for 9 shocks. In other words, here's the point I'm trying to make. That he will bar press more than 1,000 times per shock. That the strength of this punishment is so strong that it will motivate him over 1,000 times to press this bar. Do you get that? Do you see another point that I've tried to make 2 points by these 2 different experiments? One of them is that punishment seems to be more, well, it's the same point, I suppose, in 2 different ways. That punishment is more powerful than reward because we find that this same group of rats will not be able to bar press more than 600 or 700 times in order to receive a food pellet or another strong reward. That they extinguish, they stop bar pressing, they give up before 1,000 responses to gain a reward, but they'll bar press over 1,000 times to avoid the punishment. So I suppose these are just 2 experiments making the same point. That punishment here is a very strong teacher. Animals and rats do lots of things in order to escape punishment, just out of fear. They aren't even getting the shock, but they're bar pressing to avoid it. Or they're running out of the door pulling this harness to avoid, you see, just from a fear response. But let me give you, I guess that all these experiments are only making the same point. Let me tell you 2 or 3 more. A chimpanzee, and I wish I had an experiment about a pig, and I can't. I just don't know any of the literature about how pigs do on this. But I can tell you about some other animals. A chimpanzee, who was trained to do much the same, a buzzer would ring, and 5 seconds after the beginning of the ringing of the buzzer would continue to ring for those 5 seconds. The buzzer rings, and 5 seconds later, while the buzzer is continuing to ring, the chimpanzee receives an electric shock. But he has learned that he can shut off the buzzer by pulling the light switch. Buzzer buzzes, he pulls this off, and that shuts the buzzer off. Now, if he shuts the buzzer off within 5 seconds, see, the buzzer starts and 4 seconds later he shuts the buzzer off, he will not get a shock. The shock always occurs only after a buzzer has rung for a full 5 seconds. So if he continuously shuts this buzzer off, he'll never get an electric shock, provided he does this before 5 seconds of the buzzer. Well, these chimpanzees in this particular experiment are allowed to receive 3 shocks after they learn the behavior. So this might take thousands of responses at times, but the electricity is kept on until they've received 3 shocks. Some of these it'll be very few, maybe 25 or 100 pulls to shut the buzzer off, and they've already received 3 shocks because they've been more than 5 seconds. You get the point? They get, after they've learned the behavior that shutting the buzzer off turns off the shock, they're allowed to do this until they've waited past 5 seconds 3 times. So they've got 3 shocks, and that's where this experiment starts. Then they turn the electricity off, and they keep ringing the buzzer. And they find that the average chimpanzee will go between 1,500 or 2,000 times shutting off this buzzer before he extinguishes, you see, without getting any shock. He's now just reacting out of fear. He's not being reinforced anymore by electric shocks, but still shuts it off. It's very hard behavior to extinguish for a chimpanzee. For dogs, the same things, and I don't remember the amount of times, but if they're shocked on one side of a fence and jump over the fence in order to avoid the shock, they learn the behavior very well, and it's very hard to extinguish. They keep jumping over the fence even after the electricity's been shut off and they don't get a shock on this side. And many, many, many more experiments go on to show the same thing. that punishment is a very, very strong motivating force for animals. And we've extracted this, and I can't think of any really good experiments to show this, but I believe it, and I guess I'll sort of say it on the weight of evidence I know, that we can say the same thing for human beings, that self-preservation is perhaps their strongest instinct, that avoidance of pain perhaps takes precedence to any other behavior. At least it's very, very strong. A person can be strongly motivated by fear. We've really learned this through animal studies, and we're saying the same is true of human beings. But let's assume that that's true. I think it is true, and this is explained better if it is true than if it isn't. Let me tell you some results now about child rearing. In 1957, three psychologists, Sears, McAbee, and Levine, Robert Sears is probably the most famous of these three, did a study on 359, this is what the study started out with, and some of these dropped out as the study continued, but started out with 359 mothers of 5-year-old children in the area, I forget now, Sears is now at Stanford, but I believe this study took place around the Cambridge area. And what they did is they took the mothers of all these 5-year-olds scattered throughout the kindergartens of this town, and they interviewed them about all their child-rearing techniques. What did you do in child rearing up till age 5, your potty training, your breastfeeding, you see all these things that you did, including your techniques of discipline. Did you reward or did you punish your child? And they established a scale here they ranged these mothers on a continuum of from warm to cold, and they found that warm mothers most often used reward instead of punishment, that they most often were permissive, that they most often, the kinds of rewards they used were what they call love-oriented rewards, that rather than give the child a nickel, they gave him a pat on the head and praised him. Love-oriented techniques. And punishment, the cold mothers would use physical, tangible kinds of punishment. They'd withhold tangible objects like money, or they'd spank the child. The love-oriented mothers would withdraw love. They'd say, I really love you a lot more, or I'd like you better if you didn't do that, or go to your room, I don't want to see you while you're acting that way, come back when you're nicer, and would not so often spank or use tangible punishment. Now, that's sort of background for this point. Sears, McAbee, and Levine made this statement about all kinds of discipline in their children. They said that the cold mothers, or they also said it a different way, the mothers who used punishment, who used physical punishment, tangible kinds of punishment, consistently, who were consistent in their use of punishment as a child-rearing technique, would punish a change-worthy behavior only in order to see that behavior increase, not decrease, but decrease. For instance, and in these three areas it was very obvious, much more so than in the others, though this was true of every behavior. If the mother had a child who soiled its pants, she'd punish these accidents only to have a kid that wet the bed and soiled his pants all the more. If she had a kid that had eating problems, and she said, you sit there until that spinach is all eaten, and the kid says no, and she slaps his face in it. I said, you sit there, and she spanks the kid. The kid won't eat his spinach all the more. He has more eating problems. And more eating problems than just spinach. It generalizes to others. That if the kid is aggressive, has problems in that he picks on all the little kids in the neighborhood, and the mother takes him over her knee and she says, don't you ever hit little kids littler than yourself, you know, and she spanks him. And administers punishment for these three behaviors especially, eating problems, toilet training problems, and aggressive problems. The kid only increased manyfold, many times over, what the original problem was. The mothers who use love-oriented techniques had much better results in changing what they consider to be change-worthy behavior, in helping teach the child potty training, in teaching him not to be so aggressive, in teaching him to eat more foods more consistently. Now why? See, this is a problem. Assuming that these studies are accurate, and I myself believe they are, you know, not that that's so great, you know, showing their validity, But this can be very easily explained, or very consistently explained, even though these seem to contradict each other. Let me tell you the two conclusions. A human being is motivated more by fear and punishment than he is by reward and love. Animals are, and human beings in their animal nature, and as human beings also are motivated more strongly this way. Now, this both could be true, and still these results of Sears, McAbee, and Levine could be true. But why or how? See, why is it that punishment is not as effective as reward? If, in fact, punishment is a stronger motivation than reward, how could this be? I've quoted this experiment correctly, haven't I? Tell you, I suppose you're up on these things. Well, what's the answer? How can this be? What does this have to say about us? Either as parents or as teachers or people trying to shape the behavior of other organisms, or otherwise, just purely as human beings reacting to each other. Why is it more important to use love than punishment? But especially as a teaching device. Anybody have any ideas about that?
Isn't it direction? I mean, fear...
That's one possibility, but let's assume this, that this is true even of 3 and 4 year old kids who you tell them this. You see, what you're saying is that you're not telling them what they should do, you're just telling them what not to do when you punish. Isn't that what your argument is, a direction?
And they get it, but they aren't shown what to, they're shown what not to do, but it's trial and error to find out what to do.
Well, let's assume that this, I mean, in a sense, for some of the littler kids, this may have an effect, but not for the older ones, and it's still true of the older ones. Let's assume this, that the mother says, "What I want you to do is eat your spinach, like this," and she takes a spoonful and eats it. "That's what I want you to do. Don't just sit there and leave it." And the kid knows darn well that's what the mother wants. He can even say, "You want me to eat my spinach?" You know, he knows darn well. He's been shown by example. This is the direction. I want you to eat your spinach. And if you don't eat it, I'm going to whip the tar out of you. And he knows she's telling the truth. And he doesn't eat it, and she whips him, and he won't eat it next time worse. You know, he won't eat his corn either. See, so let's assume that the kid does have direction. The mother says, "What I don't want you to do is beat up on littler kids. And if you beat up on littler kids, I'm going to whip you, you know, bloody." And he picks on littler kids and she whips him and she says, "What I want you to do is be kind and loving." And she, you know, he kid knows, he understands what's wanted. Same with potty training. "What I want you to do is sit on the potty and yeah. instead of..." But he understands.
Does the human being have more potential for love than a rat?
Well, this has been suggested. It's been pretty much disproved by many of the behavioristic psychologists. Let's assume that the behaviorists are right here and that punishment is still a stronger motivation. This is something we could dispute. But even if the behaviorists are right, this, in fact, if they are right, this can be more easily explained, in fact, by the explanation given. See, that it still is very consistent to have punishment be a more powerful motive and still not be as effective. Though this is an argument that's commonly given, and the behaviorists then show experiments to show it's not true. And their whole theoretical framework is that it's not true, that really a person is more motivated to avoid, just like an animal, to avoid pain than they are to receive a reward of some type, including the presence of mother.
Depends on what the reward is that the child wants. Like, if he gets more attention by not eating his spinach, maybe forget to reward them, or pay as much attention to them, I should say.
Yeah, but what you're really doing is you're begging the question here by saying that he wants attention more than he fears punishment.
Right.
And in fact, the studies show just the opposite, that he in fact fears punishment, fears pain more than he does need this attention. Now, this is the same as her.
The punishment he gets probably isn't that great.
Well, this is even more true if the punishment is very severe. The more severe the punishment, the greater the discrepancy here. The more severe the mother is, the worse the problems the kid has in potty training and in eating and in what's the other one? Aggression.
More attention, which would be.
Isn't that kind of two different situations? Like in the one, it's just natural that if you're frustrated, you react or rebel or be aggressive against it. And if somebody's shocking me, I don't understand that. Okay, you just shock me all you want, because the shock isn't something I can fight back against, so I got to get away from it. And yet,
that's one thing, the very important point. Notice what the problem is here. The problem for the mother in this situation is to teach the kid to eat his spinach, to have potty, to go potty, and not to be aggressive. She's really in the... we call it psychologically, what she is, her goal is to shape the organism to meet her required behavior standards. In other words, she's a teaching person. Her role is as a teacher. And one of the things that she happens to be doing is not just teaching the kid to eat his spinach, but to avoid her because she's a punishing agent. So that the kid, in a sense, is learning to fear her as much as he's learning to eat his spinach. That one of the real teaching things that's happening here, one of the learning things that's happening, is he's learning to fear her as an aversive stimulus. And so many times, see, it's pretty hard for a teacher to teach something if the students don't come to class. And that does happen. The kids begin to avoid her if she's really severe in this. But that's only an incidental aspect. There's something much more important. That's true.
With I don't know how with little kids, but with older children, they often respond to what you expect of them. You know, I mean, if you indicate to them that you expect that this is the way, you know, you just trust them to do these things. I mean, you take a bunch out on a big trip or something, and you say these are the things we're going to do, and they really feel you think you're going to do this, they'll do this. And somebody else might.
Okay, let me give you a hint. Let's assume now that I'm a teacher. And you're trying to learn something. And what we're trying to learn is the answer to this problem. We've got this problem. Why do children seem to profit more or learn more easily with love instead of discipline? Now, this is our task, and I'm a teacher, and we're trying to learn. Now, one of the techniques that I could use as a teacher is I could say, "Hey, don't just sit there, I'll hit you!" You know, and I scream at her. And I really become punishing. See, I'm very much of I'm a punishing agent here. I'm delivering an aversive stimulation. And this is part of my teaching technique. If you don't learn, I'm going to flunk you, and I'm going to throw this poker at you, and I'm going to, you know, and I'm going to hit you, and I'll be very aversive, see? What happens to your thinking process?
Could it be that the child changes or has the potential to change only when the child is personally convinced that this is necessary for me as a person? The child who's having trouble being toilet trained will probably be more influenced by a child of his or her age, you know, who looks on this kind of action as being you know, unacceptable. If you as a teacher were teaching us it was snowing outside and we had to leave the camp tonight and go down to the dock, and the waves were going to be 30 feet high, and we'd have to fly on a rope, you know, to the boat. We'd all listen to every word you had to say because it has something to do, you know, for our self-preservation. To sit and talk about it now in the middle of the summer, it doesn't have much meaning.
Yeah, you're showing something that we know to be true, that relevance is very important as a learning technique.
Yeah. Now, if the child gets the message that the mother wants him to eat his spinach because she loves it, I mean, you know, that light finally flashes.
Except we're saying just the opposite, that it's more relevant to him to learn in order to avoid the punishment, that punishment is really more relevant than love here. It's a more powerful motivation.
Well, it might be for the rat.
Well, see, that's a common argument. And you might have a point that love is more powerful for human beings, and we have some examples of mothers that rush into a burning building, for instance.
But it's important for the child to eat the spinach.
But it's also important for him to avoid this spanking that he'll get if he doesn't eat it. And he doesn't need it, the worst the spanking.
Maybe you're not threatening him with a spanking if he doesn't eat it.
Yeah, but let's say you are.
Let's say you're not.
Well, then, you see...
You know, if you don't beat the kid because he's not toilet trained.
Yeah, but the problem is that the more you beat him, the less able he is to learn this, to fulfill what you want.
Right, but if you let the child become toilet trained naturally...
Well, see, I think the answer is very close to this hint that I tried to give. What happened... Go ahead, one more. Except the experiments we've had so far try to show that this is not true, that punishment really is stronger. Let me explain how this would be consistent, then we can talk about this fact, and we'll talk about what we know, whether love is more important or not.
Well, could it be that the child feels his personal life is threatened, and he has to strike back, and he knows that he doesn't do this, that's his only way of striking back,
the
rebellion.
Well, there's a sense that this is what part of the answer the psychologists say, at least, is you've hit on a very important point. And remember, this is why I'm talking about this today, as it ties in with yesterday. Let's assume, see, that this is a teaching process, and we're using fear here and pain as a teaching device. There are two things that happen. One of them is this. The child sees this as frustrating. He becomes very much afraid of a mother who threatens him seriously with pain. You see very severe spankings. And it's very frustrating for him to see this. What he wants is love. Instead, what he's threatened with is pain and punishment. And he becomes frustrated. Now, what happens to a person who's frustrated? What did we talk about yesterday, those of you? One of the first reactions to aggression or to frustration is aggression. See, the mother's frustrating him, he becomes aggressive. So one of the things he does is strike back at her. That's why one of these behaviors in here, aggression, increases. The more aggressive the mother is to the child, the more aggressive he gets back. He fights back. But frustration also causes other things aside from aggression, and they can be labeled under this general category of incompatible responses with what the mother wants to teach. See, that's what I was trying to show by shouting at her. If what I want you to do is to figure out the answer to this problem, hollering at you is going to interfere with the thinking process. Why? Because it has a physiological effect on your body that's incompatible with the learning process. What did I tell you about when I told you about these rats? Well, how we could tell it's a moderate degree of shock. These rats receive pain, and that's frustrating, but it also affects them biologically, physiologically. They defecate and they urinate. What's one of these behaviors we're talking about? Potty training. The more you holler at a kid and the more you frustrate him, the less control he has over his bowel and bladder muscles. You may have seen it yourself. I remember very clearly, it wasn't really humorous, but I watched, and this was about a 6 or 7 year old kid. He was trying to learn to, not really to play baseball, but he had a bat and a ball in his hand, and he'd throw the ball up and swing at it with the bat. And he did this about 40 times and missed, and I watched him doing this, and he got more and more frustrated and less able to really do it. And when he started out, he wasn't really too bad, but finally he was throwing it up real, real high and swinging like mad, and all of a sudden he threw the bat down and he wet his pants. And that was the only real reaction he had to this frustrating occurrence. That frustration, the more frustrated he got, the more aggressive he got, he'd swing harder, and he also he really lost control of his bladder muscles. His frustration led to, you see, to his wetting his pants. And the suggestion is this is true of the kid too. The more frightened the kid becomes, the more punishment he receives, the less able he is, just like the rat that gets a shot, the less able he is to control these muscles. What's the third behavior? Eating. We know that fear takes over, and where's Leo? Is Leo here?
Yeah.
Does fear take over the sympathetic or the autonomic or the parasympathetic nervous system? See, which of these two does it really regulate? It's the sympathetic, isn't it? Or the autonomic nervous system?
Autonomic.
Yeah. Well, I keep getting these words mixed up. Every time I study them, I learn them long enough to give my lecture, and then I forget them right away.
Yeah.
And I don't have my notes here. Anyhow, what it does, I can tell you otherwise what it does. Fear causes a secretion of adrenaline into the bloodstream, which also removes the blood from the stomach into the muscles to prepare for fight or flight, this fight or flight syndrome, so that the stomach no longer is capable of digesting food when the person is in the state of fear. The bloodstream is diverted from the stomach to other parts of the body. So when a person is afraid, what happens to his eating habits? And maybe some of you can remember times when you've really been anxious or afraid and you've been faced with whether or not to eat a large meal. You just don't eat. The kids at school realize this very commonly on final exam time, that a meal right before a very important final exam, they really skip most often. Their stomachs aren't working very well. And I've noticed this from some of the letters my brother writes me from a combat situation in North Vietnam, that the soldiers there, just before an expected battle, become extremely nauseous from fear. Many of them vomit, and they can't eat. They lose their ability to eat because of fear. So the suggestion is here for this particular study that the reason punishment is not effective as a teaching agent is because it's too strong, not because it's not strong enough. It is so strong that it takes control of your body and interferes with what you're trying to teach. If you make a person very much afraid, he can't eat, or he does become frustrated and therefore aggressive. Or otherwise, he becomes frustrated and withdraws. So he avoids the teacher. You see, it's an avoidance reaction. Or otherwise, you see, he loses control of his bowel and bladder muscles, and you're trying to teach him potty training. And all these things work together that the stronger the punishment, the less able you are to use it to teach. because it brings about an incompatible response with the desired behavior to be learned or to be taught. You see the point? That punishment is probably a much more powerful motivating force than is reward or love. This is the suggestion made by these studies. Now, what would this mean? See, about the nature of human beings, or about our reactions to various situations. What would if this is true, and my suggestion is that it is true, what does this mean about the nature of man? See, what does it say about us for the motivations for our behavior, or for, you know, the way we are built? Let me give you one suggestion about what it would mean. It would mean basically that man is more concerned with self-preservation than he is with love. That he's more selfish than he is altruistic by nature. His animal nature controls him to this extent, that he is more likely to consider himself than others. Now what I'm going to start telling you about then is a behavioristic view of man, that he will work more for his own, you see, that he can be controlled by the amount of punishments and rewards administered to him despite his the nature that theology talks about man, what we talk about his ability to love. Do you see the point? Why this would be so? That he's more concerned with self-preservation than he is anything else, if this is true. If punishment is more important a motivating force than anything else, avoidance of pain, avoidance of fear, this makes self-preservation really his most important motivating force, doesn't it? Because that's really what it does, is removes him from painful or harmful situations. Right or wrong?
Didn't the Germans do this with the Jews to control them more by punishment? They run a whole camp on the basis of fear.
Yeah, but notice another thing about the Germans did this. Would you say it was or wasn't successful?
I think it was successful, at least for two or three years.
Well, let's not take a concentration camp. I have a feeling a better example would be made if we just consider the way people's behavior is shaped by the armed forces, by the drill sergeant. What's happening there? Notice how very effective this is. I know what happens, that a human being can enter the armed forces with all kind, you know, a group of men with very divergent kind of feelings about life and motivations, and they can be shaped by their drill sergeant to react just like that and do what he tells them to. Regardless what it is, take a 20-mile hike through a swamp in the middle of the night, or stand for as many hours until they collapse, holding a 20-pound weight above their head, or anything. And how does he do this? How does he shape their behavior so they just snap to whatever he says? By fear. Very effective. But notice another thing that happens too. Not only does fear allow this drill sergeant or drill instructor to be completely in control of this person's behavior, but it also causes a real sense of frustration in the person that leads him to aggression. And part of this aggression, if possible, is going to be directed at the drill sergeant. So notice what happened in Italy when Mussolini finally toppled. What did they do to Mussolini's body? You know, a terrific amount of aggression directed towards the frustrating agent. So it's not a very effective method in that sense unless you always are in a power situation. A lot of these drill sergeants, I've been told, and I don't know what the research is about this, were found shot in the back even at times in battlefields, pretty obviously from their own troops who hated them so much for this kind of a fearful kind of discipline. You see, it's effective in a sense, but it's also ineffective because it's too strong, too uncontrollable. Yes?
You say now that the animal will respond more for self-preservation than for love, right?
That's what I'm suggesting that has been suggested.
Are there any experiments such as, I'm bringing up experiments, two rats set up in such a way that one cannot do anything for himself, mates, whatever you want to make, and there's two levers that the one can control, one to shut off these stimulant from for himself and one for the other one. Which one would you press?
Well, isn't that pretty much, Leo, that experiment you just talked about this morning with people? I mean, isn't that the same point being made? Were you here at that earlier lecture? Leo, am I speaking correctly? Doesn't that speak to the same point?
Where they try to eat food,
Well, yes, where the student would, you see, here's the situation. The student may administer an electric shock to another person, or otherwise he can receive a negative reinforcement himself by having the person say, well, you're not cooperating, or you're not, isn't that the setup pretty much? That the student receives a negative reinforcement really by not obeying the experimenter. Or otherwise, if he obeys the experimenter, he gives a negative reinforcement to the other person.
Well, I'll think quite this way. The experiment that I described was, if I was in Caruso with my wife, which I usually am, and she was cooperating with me, and I introduced to the rest of you, and I say, well, here's our experimental subject today, and she's going to be put in this room, and we're putting now the electrodes on her, and she's going to be given a series of tests. And then I bring you off to the outside of the room, and I'll say, all right, now, here is the testing apparatus, these are the series of questions going to be asked. If she gives the wrong answer, you are going to give her a shock,
uh-huh.
Starting out with 15 volts, and you're going up, with every miss, you're going up 15 volts.
Now, what happens to us if we do not shock her?
Well, you're only kind of ashamed. I mean, this was only an obedience kind of a thing.
Right.
More or less.
Right. The point I'm trying to make is that the amount of pain or the amount of negative reinforcement for the person administering the shock is really very little if they do not administer it.
That's right. It's very little.
Right. And yet, what was it? Over 30% of the subjects still administered it.
Oh, 32% went up to beyond 300.
See what I'm saying? Isn't that the same thing you're asking, really? What if you have the choice between yourself receiving a shock or someone else receiving it? And in this situation, they don't even receive it themselves. It's just a very minor form of, well, you're not cooperating in the experiment. And yet, in order to avoid that, they still give this experimental subject a very large shock, 62% of it. See, doesn't that sort of speak to the point?
Yeah, but then it's a little different because they are administering it themselves. Now, they set up the other way. They have no control over, the punishment.
I see. I don't really know of anything like that. Let me make a hypothesis, though, for us, what I think might, in fact, be supported by experimental evidence that ties together punishment now and love. See, I started out way back a long time ago, and many times have spoken to this, saying that man is by nature a social, imaginative animal, and have emphasized pretty much the social quality of man, that he needs love. That what I've said is this, that man's greatest motivation really is to receive love. Now, how does this tie? See, what I'm saying is this might not be incompatible, and that's what the hypothesis is I'm going to make to you, and then see how you react to it. That really what love is for a human being, and I define it as someone seeing good in you and being attracted to you because of that goodness, but it might have another aspect also, and Kent has spoken to this many times. If a person loves you, what he does is help remove you from a fearful situation. That being alone is a source of insecurity. The elements will get at you, other people will get at you, you're very much exposed, and what happens is this, if you are loved, that increases your degree of self-preservation. That if you're not loved, you're in a more fearful situation because you don't have the community support for you. That in a sense, there is a real sense in which love is a force that removes fear of punishment, fear of pain, fear of annihilation. That it really, really in a sense, what love really does is provide security. And that this still makes fear your most powerful motivation, or escape of pain your most powerful motivation, but love helps you avoid the fear. You'd have fear without love. You'd be too alone without love. Is this making sense to anyone? See, what I'm trying to do is say that it might be true that a human being, in one sense, a human being's most powerful motive is to receive love. That's why religious systems are so important to him, because someone's constantly loving him, watching over for him. That's why parents are so important to children. And why are parents important to children? They help him survive. They relieve his hunger. They protect him from enemies. And that's in a sense what God does to people, and it's a sense what love does to people too. It makes him feel that he's protected by this company of people who love him, and he also is protected by God, and it gives him security. So that in a sense, this is saying the same thing. and the psychologists never agree this. They can't say they're both right, but I think there is a sense they might both be. That love is man's most powerful motivation, and escape of fear and pain is also, self-preservation is also his most powerful motivation. But that in a sense, these two are just different aspects of the same thing. That love is in one way a sense of helping him survive. It gives him the support of other people, protects him from fear. Now that's a hypothesis that I sort of wanted you to be able to react to. I can see several different ways of reacting to this.
How would you explain then the phenomenon of someone giving his life for someone else?
Well, this can be done two ways. I myself believe that this is altruistic, and what it is man's attraction for good, and that it's unselfish, that it doesn't fit into this pattern when it happens. And that's, I'd like to believe this way. You see, that we talk about somebody like Schweitzer as a very great man, one who didn't fit in with the rest of us, really, because he put other people ahead of himself. Like Christ says, he's the man who gives his life that others might live. You can only really find life when you lose it. You see, you kill yourself to let others live, in a sense. It's like Christ did. You live, you die that others might live. You give of your life that they might have life. That's the way I like to look at it. But many psychologists will point out, well, Kent, go ahead. Kent has done this on various occasions too. And many other psychologists do this, say this man is really being more selfish. And, well, go ahead, you make the point. It's your point, and you okay. Make it.
I would say that man's basic drive is a drive for security or self-preservation. And there's two forms of security. First, well, highest is mental security, and second is physical security. And mental security always overrides physical security. So in other words, if I'm brought up with...
Psychologists don't agree with that, by the way. That's his own unique interpretation, but the rest of what he says, they do agree with.
If I'm conditioned to believe that I should love, that I should consider somebody else's feelings above mine or their other person, then I would be more mentally insecure if I didn't risk my life to save somebody. And then mental security would override physical security, and I'd risk my physical security in order to selfishly, in a way, provide my mental security by going into the situation.
So you're saying people are only conditioned, and psychologists go along with him one step further by saying that when people do this, like a mother rushing into a burning building to save her babies, what really she's doing is acting in a sense irrationally, that if she'd take time to figure out the consequences of this, she might not do it, that all that occurs to her immediately is the welfare of her children, and she forgets about herself. There's another thing that ties in with this. It's kind of like a man who has been condemned to die and is in front of the firing squad, and they say, ready, aim. He still has this belief, I'm really not going to die. You know, something's going to still happen to save me. He just cannot believe that he's going to die, and that many of these people really don't believe they're actually giving their lives either. Like, say, Martin Luther King and the Kennedys and these people. They really just feel that the danger is not that great, that somehow they're really not giving their lives. You see, that really they don't quite know what they're getting into, that their belief is they're still safe even though doing this, and that it really is selfish, that whatever they do unselfishly is only because if they didn't do it, they'd experience guilt because their consciences have been formed this way, and they'd have a real miserable time by not. You see, conscience can be very powerful.
So in a sense, it's still self-preservation.
Yes, according to, this is the way the behaviorists think. I myself go along with the behaviorists mostly, but say, you know, they're wrong here. I myself just have to believe that human beings actually can act unselfishly. A lot of people don't believe that. The behaviorists just do not believe it. They'll say we can make a person do absolutely anything. And well, look at it, and the armed forces do this. They tell a man, you've got to do this or you'll receive pain. And they know they will, and so they do it even though the danger is great. And they'll do many things they would never otherwise do. The armed forces can condition a person that his main goal in life is to kill. That's the only thing his goal in life is. And they'll do that. They'll put killing above anything else. I know this. I've received some very sad letters. And I've seen some people at it.
Well, if we assume that self-preservation is man's, in general, his basic goal, whether it's physical or mental or spiritual or whatever, if we assume that this is his main goal, then what's the point that the behaviorists say punishment will get him there faster or drive him there faster, and are we saying no, love will get him faster?
They're saying that what will get him there fastest is something that ensures his self-preservation, his selfish goals. This might be in the case of rewards like food that he's allowed to eat, or You see, providing in punishment by doing something else. Yes, it is, really. Because you see, they'll say that if we have this choice for a rat, we put him on a maze and he can turn right or left, and on the left is an electric shock and on right is food. We can be certain that 100% of these rats will be trained to turn right to get food rather than left to get a shock, because they have two motivations. They avoid the pain of the shock and they receive the reward of food. And the real good behaviorists work in both in connection. If they do something that they don't want to have happen, they get a shock. If they do something they want to happen, they get a reward.
But now human beings are social beings, and that we're just talking about one rat making, a choice for himself. That really doesn't affect anyone but himself.
Unless you read the behaviorists very closely and what they're doing now with human beings. They shape human beings the same way they shape rats. And see, that's why I keep referring to this military, because it's unbelievable what they can do to shape a human being. They can make him do absolutely anything he might have sworn a year ago he'd never do. See, they have almost absolute control over him. They can make him do anything within his power, even some things without his power.
Well, now, what's the application to us in our life situation?
Well, it's interesting to contemplate, isn't it? Very interesting.
What motivates the person who's not under a drill sergeant?
See, rewards and punishments.
It's not controlled by a specific person, but everything coming in, the total environment controls the individual, the same way the drill sergeant does, only to a greater degree, because the drill sergeant's not his entire environment.
See, that's something that I thought might be worth just discussing. That what's the real problem here? Does man or does man not have free will? Is he or is he not completely determined by his rewards and punishments, by his life situation, the way it's interpreted to him through his genetic or hereditary environment? Well, see, that's sort of...
environment or reward or punishment is the sum total of man's being.
What else?
How do behaviorists explain mutiny? For example,
same thing as the drill sergeant being shot in the back or Mussolini being kicked around and hung by his heels.
I mean, mutiny in the face of, it's obvious that you're not going to succeed in any kind of...
frustration. You react a lot of times irrationally under frustration. So what's your first common impulse? No, aggression. That's what mutiny is, it's aggression towards a frustrating situation.
Well, I'm thinking of Faulkner's fable, which presumably reports an actual occurrence in the First World War, where a whole army of men in the trenches just laid down their rifles at a certain time. And, this was planned and figured out. And they were all going to be court-martialed, and none of them, it was just the idea that war is wrong and we're not going to do it anymore, whatever the consequences are. And they were very highly trained, frontline men. And it was contemplated and figured out, and it wasn't just a few crackpots. And there was no way of, avoiding the consequences. The most immediate one would be that they're probably going to get their heads blown off by the enemy. However, that didn't happen. If they didn't, they were going to be court-martialed. Yes, they were.
Well, I don't know. It sounds on the surface hard to explain.
Yeah.
Well, no, it fits into what Kent was just saying. That in the, no matter what the physical punishment is there is a reward that competes with it, which is this...
Mutiny wasn't rewarded in the First World War, I don't think.
No, but you're
rewarding yourself. You're secure in the fact you know you're doing what you believe is right.
Well, yeah, but that doing what you believe is right, doesn't fit into this behavior scheme, I don't think. It doesn't fit into the idea of, emotional security within the a social context.
Because what you believe is right is in effect built up from a large number of experiences which are either rewarding or punishing to you. And your value system is in fact dependent on what has been good or bad to you in the past, punishing or rewarding.
One thing that would follow from this kind of a viewpoint is that a real Christian, the one who is the most unselfish and therefore the most able to merit heaven, you see, the one that would be most closely united with God, would in fact be the most selfish person around. Mm-hmm. Yes, it would.
Nobody's any more selfish than anybody else is.
It would mean that...
He's just doing it in a different way.
That's right, in a sense, isn't it? I mean that everybody would be completely equal in their own... Right. That no one would be better or worse than anyone else morally that way.
And this theory,
because everybody's truly conditioned by his rewards and punishments.
We only work it out differently, but the net
right.
result...
But the net result would be complete moral equality for all human beings.
This theory is kind of beneficial and hazardous at the same time. It's beneficial, I think, in the sense that if you understand that people are conditioned by their environment, then you can look at somebody and say, all right, he's a real bad character and I don't really like him, but I can't really blame him because he's what he is because of his background, what's made up of him, so I can forgive him. And this becomes really easy because you can't blame him for what he is because he is because of what's molded him.
It also would mean that anybody could do absolutely anything he wanted without fear of feeling guilty because he's not to blame. And if man truly is selfish, what the behavior of most people would be pretty destructive for other people, it seems like.
Well, where does the new conversion and all of this, the new life, come in? I mean,
it kind of cuts it out, it seems like.
Say, pardon?
It would kind of cut that out, it seems like, if we held this position.
Is there anything listed?
Yeah, it sure would be. Yeah. I don't happen to believe this myself, but I think that it's something that you will encounter, the psychologist saying. And it seems very rational. The only real reason I don't believe it is I suppose because I practice it, is that in a sense that's really true, is that I've seen people's lives be so completely changed by the administration of love that I sort of have a feeling that people really are basically are not selfish, and all it's really proving is that basically they are. Well, we'll talk again tomorrow about these things and see if we can't look at it a different way.
Yeah. Okay, I have to remember, though, it's a very complex process, and to try to predict how one will react in crises is essentially impossible. We face this as we face in our discussions on the nuclear war at Princeton, where you have, Jerry Franks there, Ty Hurst, who's certainly an outstanding psychiatrist from Canada, and Lifton from Yale. And one of the things that always disturbed me, you see, in combat, I made my living for a while in infantry combat, and it's a tough way to make a living. But the thing that bothered me, I mean, how will I react in crises, you see? And how will my associates respond in crises? And I brought this up during this discussion. I thought that certainly with all the great advances we made in all the sciences and the arts, I presented my problem that in the big war, World War II, I would make certain predictions about my associates, and many times I was wrong. You see, I could see if it was progressively things that were progressing, I could predict that they probably wouldn't last too long. But others were most spontaneous as to whether they break and other things, or in prison camp, you'd make certain predictions. And I presented this to Ty Hurst and for Lifton and Jerry Franks, and they said, well, I have bad news for you, you know. I mean, there's a very complex situation as to how will one react in a crisis. We can't make predictions. I said, can't you run through all the battery tests of all these people here and then say under these circumstances? They can't, because it's too complex, you see. But just for one reason I'll just bring up now, because I know you have to go and I have to go too, because it's in the lab they are. And that is just this matter of sleep, you know? I mean, I don't know if some of you have really, some of you complain about being tired at home, and I'm tired too.
But where you're in combat for long periods of time or for other situations where actually you go to sleep walking, I mean, you're walking and you essentially lose consciousness. And under a circumstance like this, I mean, how are you going to react, you know? It's a very complex thing. And then I was just going to say something. You know, I mentioned on this rat thing, the chief mentioned, do animals show a concern or a love, huh? I mean, they run this experiment very briefly. The rat, they tie the rat up in a rat cage, so they scream bloody murder. They tied him up by his hind leg. And then there was a bar that they could press to release him. And they said, aha, this rat, the rats are concerned about this rat that's hanging from his leg, you see, and causing all this noise. So then somebody followed up the experiment, and they put another bar in that they could either release the rat, so he quit screaming, or they could press a bar that would cause white noise, that would essentially erase the noise made by that rat hanging from his rear leg. Huh? What did the rats do then? Now they pressed the button for the white noise, and let the other guy hang by his rear leg. Or then I can also tell you about Murray's observations of chimpanzees. I mean, around the baboons. I mean, but there again, it was a crisis, but where two baboons essentially teamed up to attack, I think, a leopard. Huh? Well, the odds aren't really great there, you know. I mean, the odds are against them, you know. Well, what's this? Concern for his fellow men or survival. I mean, you know, he can go on forever.
Stupid bamboo.
No. Jerry, I don't know if I'm going to just a frustrating boy. You start understanding life. Yeah. Yeah.